This is the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast. Your hosts, Sam Harris and Nicholas Farik, digest the most interesting, informative, and topical books, giving you their biggest insights. We expose different perspectives and tools to look at the world to make you wiser than yesterday.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 9th episode of the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast. I'm Nico. I'm joined by my co-host, Sam. And today we're discussing the book Fooled by Randomness by Nassim Taleb, which was, as people call it, a very smart book. And I can't say that I disagree with that. It's definitely a smart book. And so the main premise is that randomness, chance, and luck influence our lives and our work more than we realize. And mainly because of hindsight bias and survivorship bias, we tend to forget people and things that fail, and we remember what succeeds. And then afterwards, we create reasons to make their success even bigger than it was, although it was actually random. Mild success can be explainable by skill and hard work, but wild success is usually mostly attributable to variance and luck. Anything to add, Sam?
Yeah, I think you've kind of covered it. It's just we're just not aware of how much randomness exists, and people like to explain success to their own behaviors. So like stock traders and these kind of people think that they're much better than other people at doing stuff, and they expect that all of their results are just brilliant, and this can actually lead them to have like massive failures because they get like so caught up in how good they are when actually it's just statistics of the market. If you have this money over the 7-year period, you're probably going to do quite well if you've got some knowledge of what's going on, and then you're not ready for the random events that come that will completely sort of knock you off, and you kind of get fooled by just how things are.
Did you like the fact that it talked a lot about trading and the stock market?
No. I mean, I really liked, they could have just had like one or two examples. It didn't need to constantly be about that. But it felt like it was a book more for trading almost, that happens to, if you think about it, be relevant in the rest of life, rather than a book about life that happens to be relevant for trading as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's the impression I had as well. So he says that a lot of the examples he would be using in the book, and he used in the book, are about trading, especially he's a trader himself. And I think it's, all the theories are very much applicable to trading and very well applicable. But it's true. I mean, I look into investing quite a lot. I do quite a lot of research and I'm quite involved. And so I actually really like the fact that I talked a lot about that stuff because it made me realize some mistakes in my thinking, which were relevant and useful. And so, yeah, but I can imagine if you're not involved in the stock market at all, if you don't look at stocks or funds, et cetera.
Yeah, or if you just like have a pension and do a bit of trading, it wouldn't be that relevant to you kind of thing. Even though I think it would be if you, the general concept.
Yeah, I mean, the general concept is definitely useful, but the examples, I think it's going to resonate most if you already know something about trading and stocks and the markets. Mm. So yeah, let's go into some of the interesting things that you learned.
Me telling the interesting things?
What stuck to your mind? What do you still remember from reading the book?
I think what stuck with me is I really liked some of the concepts of life as sort of non-linear, and you kind of think that, okay, if I'm always going to make kind of 10% this year doing this one behavior, I should do that. And perhaps you should maybe optimize for the random things that you're not expecting. When you're just optimizing for the normal behaviors, you're not expecting the really big things to happen. So he talks about how he trades and when things go really wrong and different, that's sort of what he's waiting for. And yeah, there's a really nice way of explaining this that I haven't really like summarized, but do you know which bits I'm talking about?
I think if I understand you well, he says that most people in the markets make a bit of money every year, small bits of money every year. But the problem is that they don't take into account the risks that they take while making that amount of money. And so whenever a very large black swan event, as he calls it, occurs, they get wiped out, as they call it. They lose all the gains that they made. And there are some very small minority of traders actually do the opposite. They lose a bit of money when things are normal, but they stand to make a lot of money when things eventually go wrong. And that just keeps on happening.
Yeah. You can think of this analogy as like entrepreneurs, as in, if you want to just make money every year, you have a job and each year you'll make money, you'll be okay. If you want to make lots of money, you need to become an entrepreneur. And statistically, 9 out of 10 times you will fail, but then you'll become a millionaire. And you need to kind of be in that sort of potential to actually for it to go really big, even though statistically, like, it won't always do that well each time, which I thought was really nice.
Yeah. Some of the concepts I'd like to overlook is, for example, whenever we make a choice, we usually tend to assess the quality of that choice by the result. And because of randomness, that actually is not the right way of looking at things. To give you one example, I'm an avid video game player, and one of the games I used to play is called Hearthstone. And Hearthstone is like a card game, which is computer-based, so you play it on your computer or your phone. And there's quite a lot of RNG in that game. And so there's a lot of randomness in it. And so quite often, you can make the correct choice and the best choice, which actually leads to you losing the game. And so what the book says is that, yeah, the correct choice could potentially be the worst one in that case in retrospect, in hindsight. And that's something that you should try and avoid. I think another way to explain this is playing poker. Let's say you're playing poker and you're very good at reading the other person, and you get two aces. And your opponent gets, if you're very good at reading him, gets a very shit hand, like a 2 and a 7. The correct thing for you to do would be to put him or yourself all in and make sure that your opponent calls. But in retrospect, when suddenly, you know, two sevens and a two get flopped, you might lose the hand. And although you made the right decision, it resulted in you losing. But that doesn't mean that that was a bad decision. It was still the correct one, and the one you should have made.
Yeah, definitely. And he kind of talks about sort of stoicism, and he's got a nice quote like, heroes are heroes because they are heroic in behavior, not because they won or lost. And so you kind of need to go through your day doing kind of the right things, even though it won't always give you the right result. But in the long term, it will, probably.
Hopefully. Yeah, I think one of the super interesting concepts there is one of alternate realities. I found that very, very interesting and super relevant. And so the concept of alternate realities is that whenever you take a decision or whenever you choose a certain path in life, you can think about it as, okay, if I had done this, let's say 1,000 times, what would have happened in most of the cases? And there, for example, he wants to make a distinction between people that were really successful out of pure luck and other that were very successful or mildly successful, let's put it that way, but that didn't rely on luck at all. Mm. For example, for some reason in the book, he refers quite often to dentists. He seems to like dentists pretty much. But if you decide to become a dentist, you will do fairly well. You'll make a good amount of money, and the variability of the money that you make will be relatively low. The main variability will be in whether you live somewhere in a poor neighborhood or somewhere in a very, very rich neighborhood. And if you live the life of a dentist, let's say 1,000 times, you will on average make, I don't know, somewhere between $1 million and $10 million, something like that. And he then compares that to a stock trader. Most stock traders actually lose money and go completely bankrupt and switch careers. And so if you become a stock trader for 1,000 times, if you analyze 1,000 alternate realities in which you become a stock trader, it's possible that in 900 of them, you lose all of your money and you have to go, you know, work at Starbucks. And in 90 of the remaining ones, you make some money and you become a millionaire. And then in 10 of the thousands realities, you make a lot of money and you become like you earn like $50 to $100 million. Mm-hmm. And for the author, there's a big difference in between these paths of lives. And that's why the concept of alternate realities is so relevant. We tend to look up to the people that earn a lot of money without taking into account the risks they took and the alternate realities that could have resulted in them being bankrupt.
Yeah.
Or not successful at all.
Then, like, if you use eToro, the social trading, it's constantly sort of saying, hey, this guy, he spent the last 3 years making like this much money. And you're like, yeah, but what about like the millions of people on your platform? And like, easily someone's going to have done that. Like, it's not because necessarily they're a genius kind of thing. What I think what's quite interesting is if you think about like sports, I mean, I interviewed an Olympian, like gold medal a few weeks ago, and asked him like, okay, if he'd done that race like 10 times, how many times would he have won it? And he was like, yeah, probably not all of them. Because he genuinely knew that he wasn't always like the fittest and the strongest. And But, you know, he is like now a gold medal winner. He's like the guy that won at the Glory. And he gives speeches about like what it is to be a winner, even though he knows that like actually it very easily could have not happened. Like, he didn't always win all like the events getting up to it and stuff. And so we like respect all these people who like, are amazing. And actually, maybe they're not necessarily the best person. I mean, sure, like Usain Bolt was like, okay, mm-hmm. he was definitely just like a cut above. As in he just always wins because so ridiculously fast. But a lot of the gold medal winners out there kind of just happened to be on the day like someone else was a bit sick or like someone else just missed a step kind of thing, and they just happened to run it in the race perfectly and so they won kind of thing. And it sort of changes yeah. what you sort of perceive of as like as greatness and stuff.
I think the definition of the best at something is not necessarily the one that wins the most important race or that receives the gold Olympic medal, but it's more accurate if it is the one that wins most of the times.
Yeah.
Right. And the problem with the Olympic Games is that although there are a few rounds, I mean, you have a few rounds where people get cut out until you get to the finals.
Yeah.
But there's like the sample size of races is not large enough to be able to say with a very high degree of statistical relevance that the winner is actually the one that is best.
Exactly. Whereas like if you think of like tennis, like the world number one is kind of the guy that's been doing the best over the season kind of thing. Whereas the person that happens to win Wimbledon this year isn't necessarily the best tennis player.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think this is actually what makes sports interesting. Mm.
Yeah. That's why like an underdog can come and win the Rugby World Cup. And you're like, fuck, this is going to be amazing. Even though technically they're not the best team because New Zealand's just like full of amazing people. And then Uruguay come and like beat them. And like it could happen. And it's amazing.
Yeah. I didn't realize this, but actually randomness is what makes sports specifically enjoyable and watching. Mm. Because you never know what's going to happen. Even if there's a 1% chance, the moment that, you know, the big underdog beats the champion, these are the most memorable events.
Definitely. Well, now we know this. Good.
One of the concepts I really enjoyed and I found really interesting was the one of the Monte Carlo simulator. And so in our discussion we just had, we discussed, you know, if you run the life of a trader or the life of a dentist 1,000 times, you know, these are the most likely outcomes, etc. And that is actually the kind of simulations that a Monte Carlo machine or calculator can do. And so the author writes that when he was young, he actually fell in love with the concept of the Monte Carlo simulator, and he used it to his advantage to see, okay, if I run this experiment or this situation X number of times, what are the most likely outcomes? And for me, it was a very, very interesting way of thinking about the world. And I'm actually interested in using one myself, you know, to answer some of the questions I might have, just to see, you know, if I'm thinking correctly about the probabilities of something happening or not. Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting. I quite like it's a pretty famous example. I've heard it before. The example of the monkeys. If you have like an infinite amount of monkeys and you put them in front of a typewriter, it is sort of guaranteed that one of them will write the Odyssey because you have infinite monkeys. So there's infinite chances for them to press like a different key each time. And at some point it'll happen to be this perfect huge book. And that's kind of like something that's hard to sort of grasp, but actually makes lots of sense.
Yeah, it's true. It's like we as humans have so many different kinds of biases that we tend to have difficulty grasping
You
know, the fact that a monkey can, you know, 100% replicate the Odyssey. And one of the most striking examples that I will not quickly forget was the one of the letter that you got in your mailbox. And so the story is, you know, 1st of January, you open your mailbox and you get a letter that says in this month, the stock market is going to go up. And so you say, okay, you discard the letter. And just out of curiosity, at the end of the month, you look at the stock market and you see that it went up. And the 1st of February, you get a letter that says, this month, the stock market is going to go down. And you say, well, okay, interesting. But you discard the letter. You don't pay too much attention to it. But at the end of the month, you look at the stock market and it effectively went down. And this continues for a few months, you know, March, April, May. The predictions of the letter that you receive in the first of the month are always correct. And then there's August and, you know, the letters were always correct. And in August, you get a letter saying you should invest in this new hedge fund because it's going to make you, it's going to give you a 100x return over the next month. And so you're like, okay, I'm definitely doing this because it was always right. And the moment you send your money to the hedge fund, it's gone and you lose everything. And apparently this is actually an existing scam where people or one person, they send out tens of thousands of letters, one half saying that stock market is going to up and the other half saying that it's going to go down. And whatever the stock market does to those halves, so the one he was corrected, he sends this, well, he splits them up and continues doing that until August, where he remains with a certain number of correct guesses. And yeah, I mean, it's a scam that works. And this is exactly how the law of large numbers works.
Just to clarify, so basically what you're saying is that each month, half of the people get the wrong letter and they don't get another letter. And so he just splits the one that got the right letter into half again and sends them two different letters the next month. And so you just go down this tree of sort of success. And if you're always the one that happens to be in the right thing, you just get more letters because you start with such a big audience. Come down to you, but it seems like you're in this unique place where like this guy's just always correct. It just comes from like statistics of lots of people.
Exactly. And this is the same concept he uses to think about successful traders or successful fund managers, where if a fund manager has a 50% chance of making money and a 50% chance of losing money, if you start with 100,000 fund managers after 15 years, it makes sense that still a number of them would have been correct each year. While it would be, and people don't really see that, but it's going to be those fund managers out of pure luck that come to your door and ask you for money and show their exquisite track record of never being wrong. But people don't think about all the 999 or 99,000 others that have failed and trying to do the same thing. And so whenever someone comes to, or someone talks about, you know, the success that they had and their track record, the author immediately always thinks about, okay, but how many people have tried and how strong is the survivor bias in this case?
Very useful.
What else interesting did I learn? Ah, yeah. One is, for example, that a bit of good luck is actually self-reinforcing. In business, for example, let's say that you made one very successful business decision out of pure luck because you make hundreds of business decisions each year. And if one of them becomes very successful and hindsight was a very good decision, you actually, because of the success, you keep like your composure changes. You puff yourself up. Let's say you're gonna appear taller. You're gonna keep your chin up, your chest up, which is actually gonna help you in other parts of the business. When you're talking to people, you're gonna appear more confident. It's gonna be easier for you to get good deals, and which might, you know, keep self-reinforcing, make better decisions. Well, be luckier in the decision that you make.
You just got more opportunities because you're kind of constantly putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big thing. Yeah, that one. And then I think sort of the stoicism mindset of expecting things to be bad sometimes and not worrying about it kind of being lost and just being able to just carry on and not. Yeah, it's sort of like a whole, because the world doesn't matter so much. You can kind of just enjoy the randomness that comes at you. Rather than, as in not being buffeted around by what happens in the world and kind of being a bit more in your own emotions rather than what happens to you deciding how you feel is something that I kind of got from it, because like the world is random and it does stuff and it's not always your fault. And so if you are more stoic about it, you are going to continue to be happy. And like you said, if you sort of can force yourself to be more confident, you will be more successful. But if you can be stoic about like your losses, then it doesn't matter because you carry on putting yourself out there to reach success. Whereas if you're not, then like the opposite of what you just said is, and if you do have losses, then that will just lead to more losses if you aren't stoic, kind of thing. So I felt like there was a whole stoic side to the book as well, which is always useful, as we know. Everyone loves some stoicism.
Although I don't know much about it, the concepts that I hear about stoicism always appeal to me very much. Although I don't really use them in daily life. But it's true. I think it's useful to rationalize some things and don't think that every good decision that you make in hindsight was because of skill. Mm. And it's good to realize that luck plays a factor in most of your decisions. And don't underestimate the role of luck. Some of the other interesting concepts was the fact that old ideas are better than new. So old ideas have been around for a long time. So a lot of people have tried to disprove these ideas. And this isn't the case for new ideas. And so new ideas can sound revolutionary and super special, and you know, history repeats itself, but this time it's different. But he says that it's always safer to put more trust in old ideas than in new, because the new haven't had the chance to be disproven yet, just by time. And for me, why is this so relevant? Is that I'm personally a big fan of cryptocurrencies. And so in the basis, I believe that there's a problem in our financial system, and especially our monetary system. And I'm a big believer in assets that don't lose their value over time. Two of the most prominent right now are gold and Bitcoin. And so I'm a big fan of Bitcoin because I believe it's like the digital gold that, you know, there's a finite supply and it has all the positive characteristics of digital money that gold doesn't. But reading this book, it's true that it puts stuff into context and it reminds me that, you know, Bitcoin is very new and it hasn't had the time to prove itself. And gold has been around for, you know, thousands of years. And perhaps it would be wise to consider gold as a potential option to, you know, hedge against inflation next to Bitcoin.
I think people do kind of worry a lot about it just being sort of digital money. And the fact that there's just lots of different cryptocurrencies. And it's like, sure, one's in finite supply, but then maybe it's the other one that works kind of thing. But then...
I mean, in the end, the fact that it's new also increases the potential positive return.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I mean, Bitcoin hasn't proven itself, which actually reduces the price. So it's the expected return is lower. But I'm a big believer, so I'm full on bullish. Mm. So yeah, let's see how correct I am and if randomness has something to say about that.
Yeah, well, certainly it pays to at least play the game a little bit, as in the risk versus reward ratio is definitely in the favor of the reward. But it depends on like where you gauge that, and it's not worth the risk of putting all your money into it kind of thing, because that would be silly. Mm-hmm. But not putting any money is missing an opportunity.
One last point I'd like to make is that the author talks about emotions and how emotions skew our perception of randomness and risks. One of the examples he gives is that if you go to the airport and you ask people how interested they would be in buying insurance for the case where their plane crashes because of terrorists, they'll give you a certain amount of money that they would be willing to pay for that insurance. And if you go to people and ask them how much they'd be willing to pay to get insured for any type of crash, they'd actually be willing to pay less than in the previous case. Although having a plane crash because of terrorism is actually a subset of having a plane crashes. And so the odds of having a plane crash in general are way higher than that of a plane crashing in the case of terrorism. And so people think or calculate probabilities with their emotions. And that is...
It isn't just emotions, it's also perception. So it's in the same way, that's why it's so valuable to tell a story when you give an example, as opposed to just talking about something. Because you can see the stories and people know that terrorists exist and they can see that happening on the plane. And there's the exact same example in, I think maybe in this book as well, but it's in a few other places. If you tell people the likelihood, you ask them to guess the likelihood of like a major flooding and tornado in after an OEP, or like an earthquake in California causing a flood, like what's the likelihood of that happening this year? And they'll give you like 20% or something. Whereas if you ask them just an act of God in the USA, which covers any earthquake, or kind of, like they'll give you more like sort of 5%. And you're like, what? Because of it's less than the very specific thing. But they can like, they can picture the earthquake happening, causing a flood in California, because that's something that's happened before. And they're like, well, this is definitely a thing. And it's like a story that makes sense to them. Whereas you're just kind of talking about like a vague thing that they don't know which one's specific. And so you give much more higher chance to these things that you can kind of picture, which is annoying when you allude to things without telling a proper story. And why you don't think about all the stuff that could happen when you just think of like a few examples of what's in your imagination. Well, when you think about what might happen in the future, you only think about things you know, like the stories that you know of. You don't think about the insane amount of possibilities of other stuff. That's why you don't think about the future properly. Mm-hmm. But yes, we're just really bad at calculating probability.
Yeah. And talking about that, the visualization and the emotion, that's where Taleb actually has a lot to say about the media and journalism, mm-hmm. where the goal of media is not to inform us.
Yeah, it's to...
It is to have us read something and to catch eyeballs, basically, which is why they are mostly using, you know, fear or in general emotions to sell something or to tell stories. And so the author actually says that you can gain an informational advantage by discarding the news.
Yeah.
So you're objectively better off by not looking at the news, because everything is brought with so much emotion, and you know, you will be biased by what they're saying. And so in order to avoid that bias, just don't look at it.
It's definitely something that helps if you travel a lot and you go to a lot of places that you hear about in the news and you see things that are sort of quite different to what you expect and what you're reading about. At the same time, you're like, wait, why is this news so different to what's actually going on, kind of thing? And you're like, the world is not as bad as you think it is. Certainly reading some books like, now I'm not going to remember the name at all, Hans Rosling. He's got a good book about the world. Factfulness. Yeah, his book about...
Factfulness, yeah.
About kind of like actual statistics of the way the world's improving and different things that's going on everywhere. And they're like, yeah, the world is not half as bad as you think it is. And it's brilliantly useful just to sort of have those kind of concepts in your brain battling against all the crap news that sort of hits you. One last thing that I don't want to say that kind of relates to this about the probability and like us not working it out properly is like statistics, we don't gauge them properly. So if you sort of hear on the weather report that like there's a 20% chance of rain, you kind of think it's just not going to rain. But that means that 1 in 5 days it's going to rain. So if you have like the next 5 days that you're going to work and it says it's a 20% chance of rain each day, that means you should take an umbrella every day because one of those days you're going to get wet, basically. And so, but you kind of think that it means that like it's really just not going to rain much, and you don't quite get that he's right. As in, if you go out on your day and it rains when they said 20% chance, the weatherman is right because of it. This is the 1 in 5 day where it's going to rain. Whereas you think that he's completely wrong if he's sort of said that, and you kind of don't quite get the weight of these statistics and what it really means. And you know, if you given a chance for like a surgery with like a 5% chance of dying kind of thing, you're like, oh yeah, it's probably pretty safe or something. Well, 95% chance of success, you're like, oh okay, cool, I'm going to be fine. And like actually 1 in 20 people are going to die from that, and that's kind of worrying.
I think the useful thing about this book is not necessarily that it helps you in making decisions under uncertainty. So it doesn't help you in understanding probabilities better, because I think we as humans are just in general bad at assessing probabilities and risks. But for me, my takeaway is that I should just realize that I'm bad at assessing probabilities and just take that into account whenever I'm making
decisions. Yeah, because he talks about himself being like, okay, I'm still really terrible at this, but like I'm at least slightly conscious of how terrible I am and I can be a bit more aware of this. And I think that's really easy.
Yeah. What did you think about the author and the way he wrote the book, the way he thinks about himself?
I don't know. As in, he's clearly really smart. But then he sort of knows he's quite smart and talks about himself as being smart and better than other people. And I'm not sure that everyone's as dumb as he's saying they are, perhaps. Or I don't know, maybe. Yeah, as in a lot of humans do want to attribute their success to these things which he's saying. Like, I think he's just overstating how stupid like some people who have been really successful are. But maybe I'm just being fooled by randomness and these people are all just completely nuts. Hard to know.
For me, I think he didn't come across as very likely.
No. He doesn't seem like he makes a lot of friends very easily.
No. I felt like some part of the book was like an attempt to write down his frustrations with like certain people who are being idolized. I mean, in the end, the book was for him not so much like a way to teach people stuff. It's just him writing down his thoughts about randomness and how we are all fooled by it. So the premise of the book is not trying to teach anyone anything. It's more like him just writing down his thoughts on a certain subject. And you can notice that. So it's although the book is very smart and he's obviously very smart, it's not like a handbook of teaching you how to think.
Yeah, definitely. I think it could have gone into much wider aspects as well in terms of when you think about how random everything is, like the world that we happen to live in is so random that we reach this, and like there could be so many different alternate realities of things that actually do work for humans. And like, there's a lot of cool, deep stuff you could go into with that, which he kind of just didn't mention at all. And okay, maybe it's a book about, investing in this kind of stuff. But there was a lot of interesting things that he could have covered besides banking and investing and things.
But perhaps he will talk about those things in one of the next books.
It's good to have a focus. And maybe, you know, perhaps it became more niche because of it was specific, and like a lot of bankers, investors read it and it became like well known in that area. It's actually, it's useful for other people. Whereas if it was just like a vague book about everything, maybe no one would have been thinking it was for them. Who knows?
I think we'll have a better understanding, or perhaps he's going to go more in depth into the other concepts in the next books, which we will be reading in the following weeks. Mm-hmm. And we will be discussing in the following episodes. Yeah. So we decided to complete his four books, which are first Fooled by Randomness, which we just did, then The Black Swan, then The Bed of Procrustes, and then Anti-Fragile and Skin in the Game. So it's five books. And so over the next five episodes, we'll be discussing them. Those.
Oh, joy. It's going to be great.
Yay. Yeah, I mean, it's heavy. It's heavy. But we'll manage to get through, I think.
Doing this for you guys.
Yeah. Please enjoy this. Anyway, in general, so tell me, what would you be your score on this book?
I guess six. I don't know, it's a really good concept, but I've heard some of my favorite moments were concepts I've already read before, like the infinite monkeys and the statistics of like the weather event, that kind of thing. I've already heard all that before. So maybe he was the person that found this. It's hard to know when you just read things in the wrong order. But I didn't feel like the biggest take homes were stuff I hadn't heard before. And it's just a lot longer and denser than it needs to be to explain the things that you remember. So I felt like it could have been written in a much nicer way in that sense. So that's why I'm giving it a lower score. But if you do want, certainly if you're an investor, you should just read this book if you haven't, because yeah, you can do really stupid things. And it's good to acknowledge that a lot of them are bonkers. And yeah, it's very useful for that.
Yeah, agreed. I think if you make any decisions based on randomness, this is a very interesting book to read. That being said, it could definitely be half as long. And so a lot of the frustration that the author has for certain people, certain things, certain concepts, don't really need to be in there to bring home the point that the book makes, or at least that the one that I take away. So I'm also going to give it a six. It's a very interesting concept, but could be condensed down more. But yeah, I mean, if you... I would say it's a very interesting read, and everyone would derive some value from it, because all the concepts are useful in daily life anyway. So
yeah.
All right. So that's something you would like to add?
I was just gonna say, in terms of our scoring system, maybe we should write down our score each individually before we say it to see if we don't get affected. So certainly if I say something like a nine and then you say a six, I'm always like, oh yeah, maybe I meant like seven or an eight. Whereas if I hear yours first, I then like maybe come up to meet you a bit more. So perhaps it's worth like getting a more accurate version of what your just pure thought was initially before you've heard mine.
It's a good point. Good point. No, it's true, because I think if you hadn't said six, I would have said seven. All right. Next time we're going to write it down in our notes. All right. I think this concludes the episode. Next episode, we're going to be discussing The Black Swan by the same author. Bear with us in reading it. Speak soon.
Ciao.